Welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled, I don't know, Millennial Burial Ground. I'm gonna steal that. I'm gonna steal part of that title of the book. And it is about, well, poetics, memory, sacred millennial burial grounds. And in the promise of the last like three, four, five episodes, I said the next host. Or the next guest was going to be John Dorsey. Well, guess what? Finally, our guest for this episode is John Dorsey. John, thank you so much for coming out and being on the podcast.
Oh, yeah, happy to do it.
And we're happy to have you. And we're going to talk about a number of things today. I guess, what do you want to talk about first? We could talk about. I want to talk about how prolific you are as an artist. You got some, speaking of which, you have some projects in progress. You have a reading coming up in Portsmouth, Ohio, and there's also three books sitting on my desk that I read to prep for this podcast. Where would you like to start?
No, I mean, I'm prolific in large part for what might be viewed as nefarious reasons in that, like, I told someone the other day, they told me they were jealous of my productivity, and I told them if I wasn't productive, I wouldn't eat, which is pretty true. I've only sort of worked part-time for about the last 20 three odd years. In the last 8 or 9 years, I've just done poetry more or less for a living, which makes me a crazy maniac. But, so I kind of have to do it. And, spiritually, I sort of have to do it as well. We have to write poems. But I'm happy that I'm in that situation because I probably wouldn't get half the work done that I do if I didn't have wasn't required to do it.
Which honestly, I find that admirable that, they say what you bet on yourself. I know for me, poetry is often this, it is this spiritual thing, but it is also this back burner thing that I got work emails I got to deal with. And
Sure.
so I think eating is, there's nothing nefarious about eating.
Well, I have work emails too, except those work emails are related to poetry. And like
Which
booking, dealing with publishers, booking readings different places. I've actually recently been thinking about hiring a booking agent to take on just paid readings and have someone actually take that part of the load off of my hands.
wow, actually, so this is what I want to talk about now is how do you manage all of that? Because I think I know I'm teaching advanced poetry workshop this semester. And so all
Sure.
of my students have had poetry workshop, have taken it, are taking it seriously. They want to be writers, but yet having a career in the arts, or at least having like, even if it's not your only gig, but just being able to maintain some sort of presence in the world as an artist, that it's not just this thing you did in college because you need a free elective.
Yeah.
It feels like this utterly mystical thing to them. And if I can confess, it feels that way a little bit to me too, actually.
I think like, in a lot of people write in high school, a lot of people write in college because, a lot of that's assigned. And the trick at a point when you're no longer in an academic program is to just do it because you want to do it. And that's the reason why a lot of people don't continue on because
Yeah.
they don't have the pressure of it being assigned work. And so they have other things they have to go do. And I don't blame them for that. But I don't know. I was just one of the crazy people that for whatever reason kept doing it. And believe me, I've thought about quitting over the years. I probably thought about quitting like a month ago, but for whatever reason, I've stuck with it and I actually love it more than I did when I was 15. And I think that's the key. You have to keep loving it. If you don't, there are plenty of other things to do in this world.
That is true. That is true. And so when you are sort of managing and dealing with publishers and bookings and stuff, like what are the mechanics of that look like? Because I think the other part of the other issue I see in my friend group, in the young people I teach sometimes, is that it is this almost all very romantic sort of thing. Like the muse just comes and then eventually Penguin sends you a contract or something, which
You
no.
have to take that out of it. I mean, I love it, but it's not this inspirational thing about like flowers and beauty. Like a lot of my poems are about grime and dirtier things anyway, but it's a job and you have to
Yeah.
treat it like a job. And in terms of, I'll talk about the publishing, which is I have had a process probably for the last 10 years now where, say, you're a publisher and you contact me and you want me to publish a book on your imprint. If I like the imprint, I'll agree to do it. You give me, like, say, 8 weeks to come up with a book. And at the end of that 8 weeks, I'll have the whole book done. And I have to because I have to move on to the next book.
Wow. So how many books do you have under your belt at this point?
May 5th, I'm going to have my first book released in Germany. And when that book comes out, that should be, if my numbers are not incorrect, number 100.
Wow. Wow. That makes you, in my book, that makes you the Bob Pollard of contemporary poetry.
Well, I am something. I don't know what I am, but I'm stubborn because I don't really quit, so.
No, and again, all of this I admire about you. I mean, it's not just that, it's just that it's also there's a quality of work that I find admirable. I had a very enjoyable few days prepping for this podcast, reading Dead Photographs, Sacred Millennial Burial Ground, and Essential Heartbeats for Fried Chicken Nights on
Yeah,
my way to bed.
with something like Dead Photographs, that was about trying something different, because it's very different than the other two books. I think that you have to take chances and keep trying different things. Otherwise, like, I don't see the point in continuing. But yeah, I mean, you kind of have to n know your own voice, and once you get to the point where you do, I think it's a lot easier to like keep producing quality work.
Yeah, I one of the things I talk to my students about to encourage them to, not just lean on the muse, but to write regularly is this idea of, learning to think in form and
Sure.
learning to think in their own unique poetic voice.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to make a lot of mistakes before you kind of figure out who you are. But that's all part of the process. And yeah, trying to figure that out, trying to find that voice. I mean, that can be time consuming. I think it took John Berryman until he was like 40 years old.
Yeah. I think it took me till I was 36 before I think I finally wrote the first thing that came out the way that I liked it.
Yeah, if you read J any John Berryman from like his 20s and 30s, it's just garbage. It really is. It is. And then something happened, like a light switched on, and that's comforting. It's comforting because it makes me think, like, if you just keep working at it and try to figure out who you are, eventually you'll get there. So I actually think his story is kind of heartwarming in its own way, even though it took him a really long time.
Yeah, I mean Jack Gilbert too. I always feel like, Jack Gilbert, I don't have to feel like I wasted my talent. For I got another like 30 years before I start having that midlife crisis.
Yeah, I mean, Jack Gilbert didn't put out anything between views of Jeopardy and monoliths. So, take your time.
Take your time, but I'm impatient. And again, I admire, that you can manage multiple projects or that you can like kind of barrel through. I mean, and I was thinking about with also that sort of somewhat romantic idealism. I was talking to an old friend who was kind of shocked, borderline, I would say appalled, maybe, but a little bit, that I had a poetry submission spreadsheet that I kept. That I
Well,
just knew what was out there, what I sent people, and what happened. And he's like, you got a spreadsheet? And I was like, yeah, I got a spreadsheet, man.
that does take some of the romanticism out of it, I guess, but I understand the value of that. I don't keep a spreadsheet. I probably should, in terms of the magazines. In terms of the books, I can juggle all that in my head.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy, but.
So, do you keep notes? Do you have, is it all just mental in terms of like magazine submissions?
Yeah, my memory is near photographic, so
Oh, wow.
I can usually remember for about 2 or 3 years where everything is. After that, even I can't recall. But
Two or three years is admirable.
the way I look at it is after 2 or 3 years, it doesn't matter anyway, because if you recirculate something that's already that old, who cares? Because the original publication, unless you're in like some big thing, like it's long forgotten.
Wow. Still 2 or 3 years. I mean, I walked to I, there's now they opened an Aldi in my neighborhood. And it's a 15-minute walk, and I still made a store list because I knew that by the time I got there and I crossed Penn Avenue, it wouldn't it w I would have just been like, "What am I here for? Eggs? What?"
Yeah, the one list, I'll do stuff like that too, 'cause regular everyday things, sometimes I'll forget those, or like if I need to remember an idea I had for a poem, I keep a little Moleskine notebook, and all it is like one sentence ideas for poems in there.
Wow. Yeah, which is so as you say about photographic memory, and I'm thinking about, and I also actually I also though we talked about them last time, I also reread Send Down at the Redneck Car from a Vol and Afterlife Karaoke. And there is that sequence in Sundown about like Trailer Park Song 1984, Trailer Park Song 1996, like I'm sure that if having a photographic memory has to like all of your life experiences are then like a sort of a gold mine. Like there's always something in the well then to remember, even if you want to forget it.
Yeah, much more so than probably the average person in terms of what they remember. Yeah, there are things obviously in my life I'd like to forget, but they usually make good fodder for poems, so you keep that stuff.
Yeah.
I've got a memory from when we lived in the trailer park. There was a man that had been stabbed by his wife, and they were taking him away on a gurney, and I just remember him smoking a cigarette on the while he was on the gurney, and the only thing he said to his wife is he just reminded her to play his lottery numbers.
Wow.
Yeah, and that happened when I was about 12, and I've never forgotten it.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, wow. That's intense and memorable. And there's a whole world in that domestic life, that peek in.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing with the cigarette that they would never let you do now. It's kind of like how when I used to go on Greyhound, you used to be able to smoke cigarettes and drink whiskey if you wanted to.
Oh man, future generations will never know what they took from us.
No, not at all.
Oh man. So dead photographs is a different process. Could we talk about that a little bit? I mean, they're definitely different kinds of poems.
Yeah, they're taken from I was doing erasure again, which I did a bit of in 2021, but then I came back to it last year because I found the poetry of Barry Gifford. And Barry Gifford is one of my biggest inspirations. He's really a genius. He's primarily known for having written the screenplay for David Lynch's movie Wild at Heart. But his real contribution is his poems. His poems are just, they're amazing. And so I was just so blown away by him that I wanted to go back in and try to do some erasure work again. And he seemed ideal because he was the only thing I was reading at the time. And you can't do that sort of work with everybody. It has to gel right in your head. And I actually wrote all the pieces that are in Dead Photographs, and I believe there are 140 in there, and I wrote all of them in like 8 days.
Oh. Oh. Oh, well, and I guess, the thing with erasure then too is you're not fully in control.
No, you have to deal with the words as they are there in front of you. My process with erasure is that I take no more than two words for any one line in the original poem. And then I go from top to bottom. So I may only take one word out of each sentence in a stanza, or I may take two, but I don't take more than two.
Oh, wow.
That's just sort of my own honor code, because you don't want to steal from someone and you want it to still be your writing. So that's my process.
That's amazing. And these are, I guess you'd call them nirku.
Kind of, yeah, they're close to being haiku. That's sort of how they come out when I write erasure. I've seen other people do longer pieces. But honestly, I don't think I have the patience for it. And to me, they come out as these tiny little things. And I really enjoy it a lot. Some people look down on erasure. I love it. It gets my head moving. And when I can't write my own original poems, I'll just go in and do that sometimes just to get my brain working properly.
It's amazing. I realize we are almost, we're 18 minutes into this podcast, and we
That's
have
good.
not read a poem yet. Or you haven't read a poem yet, and you read so well. And I was wondering if you could hit us with whether you want to do something from Dead Photographs or something new or something from Sacred Millennial Burial Ground.
I'll do something from Sacred Millennial Burial Ground because I've been
Wonderful.
reading from that pretty exclusively for since it came out. I've got a ton of new stuff, but I don't have it printed out, so.
Nice.
You mentioned Damian Rucci coming from Johnstown. So
Yeah.
I'll read this poem I wrote for him. And he's got an obsession with poems about the moon or people that write poems about the moon, and he'll complain about it all day. And when the eclipse happened last year, I wrote this poem for him. It's called When the Eclipse Was Every Day. I can't expect you to know what it felt like to play kickball under the moonlit Pennsylvania sky in 1986, when the magic of the wind was just something we felt in our bones, when we called our God Houdini, when we found love in shopping malls and video arcades that had sprung up like temples under the sky's infinite grace, when we waited for Halley's Comet. Listening with our ears to the ground as if cupping seashells on dry land. I can't expect you to know all that the moon was once a hopeful thing, and that now I shake at night instead of sleeping soundly, because sleep is for the young, and those unemployed by constant worry. Now I pace back and forth, sweeping up moon dust in non-existent dreams, and have nowhere to put it all. But I'll tell you, when you run out of hope, you'll look up at the sky with wonder and see a boy in your reflection, and you will miss it.
That's a damn fine moon poem.
Yeah, I wanted to really kind of screw with Damien and prove to him that poems that mention the moon can still be good.
Yeah, well, you know, I have one, and I know there was a talk of a compilation of them at one point, and I wrote for it that basically it's like, I just want my students to get to the moon poem sometime. If it's Poetry Workshop 1, get to the moon. Instead of naming your emotions, use the metaphor. And this does so much more than that. Like, if all moon poems were like this, he wouldn't have those memes.
Probably not. I just wanted to make sure that I made mention of the moon, but it's just sort of a hanger for everything else that comes. But yeah, that compilation will be out, I think, in the next month of the moon poems. And I know, ironically, Ted Kooser's in there.
Wow, that's wow. That's wild.
Yeah. My problem is I gave three poems for that moon book, and then I kept writing these poems that mention the moon, and now I have like 10 of them.
That's lovely. That's, you know, that line from Ben-Hur, spite keeps a man alive or something, but yeah.
Well, you know, Damien, I've known him for a very long time. In the context of his life, he's a young guy. I've known him for at least 10 years. And, you know, he's like a younger brother to me. So he deserves a little spite.
Yes. Yes. It's exciting to have him in Western PA, I got to say. When he showed up at that reading last weekend, I was like, it's that guy from the internet.
Oh, yeah. He's, you know, he is sort of that guy from the internet. He's also a pretty exciting guy that brings a lot of energy. I think his plan is to be there for 6 months, and he's just recharging his batteries in Johnstown, and he's actually just there to compile another book of poems.
Yeah, that's, we talked about that, and we talked about how Johnstown came together, and we talked about how I was one of the many Pennsylvania people who tried warning him about Johnstown, but it seems to be working out, and it seems to be all right, and it seems to be part of the plan.
I mean, I guess if you're from New Jersey, how bad can Johnstown be? So,
well, you know, I have a very similar trajectory. I grew up in New Jersey, and my mom's family is from Johnstown.
I like Johnstown, but then again, I haven't spent any significant amount of time there for a while.
Yeah, it's it is something. It is unique. I always, even as a kid, it felt like another world. I was coming from New Jersey, and then now that I live in Pittsburgh, it still sometimes feels like another world when I visit.
Yeah, when I travel for readings and things, I'll go through these small towns, and you know, I often think about like, what are these people having for dinner tonight? What is their life like? And I know that their life is probably not any more exciting than mine. But it's not my life. So to me, like, it seems exciting, whatever it is they could be doing. Like, I'm interested. And I think about that every town I go through.
Yeah. So, you know, you do travel a lot for readings. How does that affect your process? How does that affect inspiration? How does that affect your sense of maybe poetic space?
Well, one thing I'll say just straightforwardly is like, I definitely write more, when I'm traveling more. It just, you observe things out in the world and those things become fodder for poems. And I find, like I was kind of saying, I find other people's story much more interesting than my own. And then if I see a little snippet, I'll try to imagine what the larger story is. And maybe that isn't the story of the person's life completely, but I'm just going through in a car and I'm there for like maybe 5 minutes driving through town, and then I have to imagine what their life is like, and that becomes a poem, and it does increase my productivity. A lot of times I'm not smart enough to carry a notebook with me during those times, but sometimes I am. Victor Clevenger is good about that. He always carries something on him as he's going through towns with me, and sometimes he'll have to stop the car to write a poem.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Yeah, Scott Silsby is trying to convert me into the shirt pocket notebook crew.
Well, Scott's a wise man. I would take him up on his knowledge.
Yes. I also wonder, does he have a cataloging? I should ask him this, or maybe this is the test to see if he listens to these. If he does have like a cataloging system for notebooks.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll tell you one thing about Scott is that he has been wonderfully generous with me in terms of he'll just say he'll talk to me and he'll be like, "Oh, I think you'd like this book," and then it'll just show up in the mail. And he'll send me random novels I didn't have, and he's really
Yes, he is very good with that too.
he's an instigator of productivity.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
So,
Or maybe just we all need spreadsheets. Maybe that's actually what this podcast should be titled. We all need spreadsheets. Scott
yeah,
needs a
there you
notebook spreadsheet. We need submission said spreadsheets.
I at least need to start just carrying around a Moleskine notebook everywhere. I don't know about the spreadsheets, but I should be better about just having some paper handy whenever I do experience anything that might lead to any piece of writing.
Yeah. Speaking of which, can we hear some more poems?
Sure. Let's see here. I read this. I wrote this poem after I read at St. Louis Community College, because they just seemed to employ a lot of guys that were there blowing leaves in the middle of winter, and it was really windy, and they'd blow the leaves, and as soon as they blowed them, they'd be right back where they were before, and it seemed like a futile uphill journey. But this is a poem called Poem for David Taylor, who's my friend who is the chair of the English department there. All across campus, grown men blow leaves from one side of the pavement to another. Men with families who don't care whether they're oak, maple, or elm, as long as there are health benefits at the end of the day. And you joke that every time I sneeze, another poem comes out. But I've sneezed 3 times in the last hour. And all I can do is shake while reading about an actor who died of cancer at 53, while I watch a hummingbird fly away and listen to stray gunshots coming from the woods. But that only makes up about half a poem at most. It certainly isn't music on a cold morning. I wipe my nose on my shirt sleeve like a child who has never had to blow leaves. Only love them. And there are still no words as I wave my arms up and down like a dying bird without ever once reaching for a pen. Let's see here. I read this little poem. I was watching these videos of poetry readings from San Francisco State University that were recorded in the 1970s. And one of them, the woman, the poems were wonderful, but the woman was so visually kind of stunning. She was a striking woman. She was really young at the time. And I wrote this poem for her about her because my first morbid thought was, this video is from like 1976. I wonder if she is dead now. And that's the first thing I thought about. This is called A Poem is a Time Machine. In 1976, a beautiful girl reads a poem. Her lips are grainy. Her words are soft. And watching from the future, you wonder if she is dead. And I'll read one more here. Actually, maybe two. I have this poem for my great grandmother, and my great grandmother was a sort of hill person who was very country simple, and she'd be very sweet to your face, but that sweetness wasn't really real. She like a lot, yeah. It's and so this poem is called "Bless Your Heart." My great grandmother sits in a deck chair outside of a trailer with no heat or running water, where generations of family defects float away in a creek of dark thoughts. Fingers folded, country simple. The children know what that means and go inside, away from the depression, away from tears, the flavor of moonshine, hidden under goose down pillows, where sunflowers can't hide behind a hard life. Even with a tongue as sweet as molasses. And I'm gonna read one more poem here and then we'll talk again. This is just a poem I wrote for one of the nurses in the cancer clinic. Her name is Casey. I actually saw her again just recently. When I met her, she wanted to steal my winter coat, which I got from Savers in Toledo. Poem for Casey. After you check my blood pressure, you smile while threatening to steal my prized winter coat, asking where I got it. On a cold day in Ohio, so vivid that we can both almost still see it, even though you were never there. After nearly 15 years, one of the sleeves coming apart at the seams will require another glaze of Gorilla Glue before the winter sets in. But like you, some things are one of a kind. I want to take you back into my past when everything still felt soft and smelled like a field of red carnations, where you could feel my heart beating as I imagine wiping the snow from your lips and placing the coat over your slim shoulders in repose.
One of the things I really love about your poems, in particular a poem like this, the way that we start in one place and then we get to this sort of profound, like deeper emotional meaning of that moment, of that exchange, of that interaction with that person. And to do so in such a way that, speaking of Ted Kooser, he talks about in his book, his craft book, The Home Poetry Repair Manual, that a poem should be like a glass bottom boat, that it will take you somewhere and you can see through it completely transparently, and it doesn't at any point get in the way. It does not, you're not maybe aware of it as a device. And I think your style is so wonderful in that it really is this incredible vehicle for that.
Well, Richard Hugo, who's one of my big heroes, there's a documentary that was made about him for public television in the 70s. And in one mo at one mo I'll send it to you. I'll send it if you haven't seen it.
Oh, I've
But
seen it. It's wonderful. And I will put the link when I post this podcast because everybody needs to see it.
they do. There's a moment where he's talking to his poetry workshop students and he gets angry at a girl because she's too, basically too flowery. And he says that poetry is the art of meaning what you say. And I think that's one of the most wonderful things I've ever heard, because for me, that's what it is. It's about like being genuine, whether it's my story or someone else's.
Yeah, and I've assigned students a triggering town, and I also think about, and it's like a poem for Casey, where he talks about the sort of the generative subject and then the poetic subject, and like that moment when the poem takes over, and like learning to embrace that moment.
Yeah, I mean, Philip Levine is great at that as well. And he's someone I've come to really later in life, but I've been reading a lot of in the last year.
Yeah, so what happens for you, like, men, just sort of maybe mentally, when when the poem takes over?
When the poem takes over, I know that I'm going to be able to finish the poem. I mean, that's the best part of it. When you get so deep that you couldn't, even if you're writing about yourself, if you actually at that point take a minute and you're kind of outside yourself, which is great because so much of the poetry that I hear at poetry readings is just self-absorption. And when the poem takes over, it's the opposite of that. It's about like just, it's about the po it's no longer about you. It's about the poem itself, and it's about the potential reader of the poem. And it's a thin line. I mean, this is a subject that might be touchy with certain people now, like the whole concept of trauma dumping in poetry. And one can make an argument because I talk about having had cancer and all of those things that I'm trauma dumping as well. But I think that, if you're thinking about other people and how they'll relate to it and not just yourself, then I don't think you're doing that.
Yeah. Which is also a Damien Rushi set of memes.
Well, yeah, Damien has had to deal probably with more of that than almost anyone on the earth. Because at one point he had like 40 poetry readings under his banner of things he was either hosting or he had a friend hosting on his behalf. So, yeah, while I've probably given, I don't know, a thousand readings or more in my life and have gone to probably twice that, but he's done more in the last few years than I'll probably ever do.
And I, haven't thought about the Hugo thing and trauma dumping, but man, that's so on point. Sorry, I'm having a revelation moment.
No,
Sorry.
it's okay. Every time I hear Richard Hugo talk, I have a revelation moment. He's just so wonderful. He's so wonderful. One of the best recordings I've heard of him. I'm trying to remember the poem. It's a title poem from one of his books. What Thou Lovest Well Remains American. That's what it is. And it's a recording that he did for the International Poetry Forum in Pittsburgh. And it's just wonderful. And he talks probably for more time than he spends actually reading the poem. But I mean, that's the part that's delightful, hearing his thoughts on things.
No, the Triggering Town, I love arguing with that book.
Yeah, I have that. I wish I could say that I was more well versed in it than I am. Another book on kind of writing and poetics that I find to be wonderful that I would recommend to any college student is a book that Ted Berrigan did. And it's a book of just his essays on his experience teaching. And it's called On the Level Every Day. And I've always loved that title because I think that's one thing Ted Berrigan was. He was on the level.
I will check that out, damn it.
Yeah, he was a fascinating character. And like, he wasn't always the most scrupulous person, but when it came to talking about writing and poetics and anything like that, he was pretty spot on.
Which is part of, actually, I will say selfishly too, part of what I love about these podcasts is we get to have these conversations and I get to pick other people's brains and then steal from their brains.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to like being in a classroom again. I just gave I was a guest lecturer for four different classes at Weber State University in Utah in January. And that's something that I do probably three or four times a year. And I have to go back and speak at the University of Missouri in October. And I'm looking forward to that.
Awesome. So what else do you have coming up? What other projects are in progress?
Okay, that's a good question. Jason Reberg and I and an assortment of other people for the last 5 or 6 years, and this started with Damien too. We started this group called the New Prophets, and so about once a year there'll be a New Prophets book. I've only been in the first one up till now, but I'm in the new one that'll be out at the end of this month, and that's going to feature Abraham Smith, who, if you don't know Abraham Smith, you should. He wrote a book-length poem about Hank Williams Sr. That I think is just brilliant. It's just a book called Hank, and it was released by Action Books. Yeah, it'll be a book of me, Abraham, Justin Ham, who wrote the book Odeth, and Jason himself, and that'll be out at the end of March for AWP. And then the book in Germany that I was talking about is on a press called Sacred Parasite. And that's going to be issued limited edition in Berlin, and it'll be available May 5th. And the book is called 100 Mornings. And that's going to be my poems in art by an artist in Germany named Julianne Hundermark. And she's quite amazing. I could send you a link to her work. But I just finished a chapbook called Vacation Days for Maverick Duck Press in New Jersey, which is run by Kendall Bell. And I still have to find out when he's going to release that. And then I have another little chapbook that's being released by Pure Sleaze in Indiana called Feline, and that'll be out in July. So that's like four projects that I have coming up. I have offers for three or four more that'll probably happen this year. I've got a reading after that Portsmouth reading. I've got a reading in Sacramento, in California, at the Sacramento Poetry Center. And then I've got the thing at the University of Missouri, and then I've got to read at the Barron Arts Center in Woodbridge, New Jersey in the fall. But my schedule for me actually is pretty light at this point.
That's wild. That sounds like a lot. That's wild.
It's not a lot in terms of readings, but yeah, the publishing, yeah, I tell people that I generally published the last like 8 or 9 years, probably like eight books a year, somewhere in that neighborhood. And this year will be like that too. It's going to be definitely be like that.
And so if somebody wants to buy your books, what is the best way for them to do so? What is the best?
Well, I either by contacting me on Facebook or Instagram, or but just by going to like Amazon or Barnes and Noble, if the book is available in that format. Now, this book that I just finished, 100 Mornings, which is going to be published in Germany, that's limited edition, limited to 200 copies, and it is only going to be available through the press website, which is Sacred Parasite. And that's run by a gentleman named Kevin Tosca. And I would assume if you got a hold of Kevin, you could get the book from him as well, direct. So,
Cool.
and
And yeah,
that's the
but
book. That's the book that I'm really trying to push when that comes out. But right now, Amazon or just me direct is probably best for the existing titles.
Cool. I will definitely push you direct and have links to your Facebook when I
I
post this.
appreciate it.
Yes.
Yeah. Like I've worked with the press in London, Tangerine Press, for the last decade, and they have a wonderful website, which is just thetangerinepress.com. And I've done four books with them. I think two were still available on their site, so.
Cool. I will post those as well. Post those as well. So now I think it's time for the bottom five. And I care so much about this. I looked up our previous podcast. I looked up the form, so I will not ask you the same questions twice. Our bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and/or philosophical nature. John, are you ready?
I am ready.
All right, question one. It's more of a prompt, actually. This isn't even a question. There are five questions, and this sentence ends in a period, and it's an imperative. Name a film world you would like to visit or live in permanently.
Oh, that's interesting. When I got interested in films, the filmmaker that did that for me was Hal Hartley. I don't know if you've watched his films. He's just miraculous, and all of these films are shot and take place primarily in Long Island. So I would not that I'm dreaming of going to Long Island, but I would love to be a part of Hal Hartley's film world. Also the movie Ghost World, people were seeing that with
Oh, yes.
I would just like to live inside that movie and date all of the girls in there. I mean, it's
Yes.
wonderful.
Yes. Go well. So what's Hal Hartley known for? What are his some of his films?
He did a film called Trust. He did another, he has a film called The Unbelievable Truth, a one called Simple Men. And my experience seeing Simple Men was interesting because my brother and I were home alone because my parents had gone out to dinner and they played it on PBS's American Master Series.
Oh,
So
wow.
that was my first experience watching that on Channel 13 in Pittsburgh on PBS.
WQED.
Yeah, that's right. And Hal Hartley specializes in making films that cost like $50,000. And he went to college with Edie Falco from The Sopranos, and she's in a lot of his movies because of it. Her, Parker Posey, he's just extraordinary. And he made me want to make films, which I attempted for a little while, but the reason I have a college degree at all is because of him.
Wonderful. I need to get on this. I need to get on Hal Hartley. All right. Question two. If there is a hell and you end up there, name one celebrity that you either expect or hope to meet.
Oh, if there is a hell, the celebrity I'd like to meet would be Charlie Sheen because he's in there. There are plenty of them I expect to meet. The celebrity I truly would like to spend time with is Nicolas Cage, but he's a saintly man. I don't expect he'll actually be in hell.
Ooh. That's ooh. Oh, that's so good. So what did you think of Long Legs? This is not a bottom five question. Have you seen Long Legs yet?
I have seen Long Legs. I've seen it a few times because it's not the kind of movie I think where you can really figure out the whole thing by watching it once. I think you need to watch it more than once. And then when I watched it the second time, or maybe the third time, because I've seen it about three times, I really kind of got some things that I didn't understand at first.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that film. For me, I would have left after the second act. Then
Yeah,
it's the best episode of X-Files that I've seen in decades without the like Mulder, Scully sexual tension. It's just they're looking for this guy, they're FBI agents, they're messed up with their job, and the world is hopeless. The end.
I might have felt that way had I only watched it one time. It really took watching it a second time. And I came to the conclusion that, 'cause at the beginning of the movie, he says, I don't have my long legs, or I forgot my long legs. And then you get deeper into the movie where the thing about the dolls and all that. And I thought to myself, well, the dolls are long legs, and everybody has their own long legs, and it's the doll, and that's what they're talking about.
Yeah, and I like the white jean jacket. I like the white jean jacket and T-Rex. So maybe I will check that one out again.
Yeah, I mean, that's not my favorite of his films, but it's interesting since I've watched it more than once. I mean, I think for me, it comes down between Pig, which I think is such genius, and Moonstruck.
Moonstruck. First VHS tape my family ever rented.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. Question three. Name a food you wished you liked but don't.
That I wish I liked. Well, I don't eat cheese on anything, so I was always the kid at the pizza party in school eating a peanut butter sandwich.
Oh, that'll do it.
So, yeah, maybe that, even though I don't really overly regret it now as a middle-aged man. But yeah, I was pretty sad and lonely at the pizza party.
All right. Question four. What is the most comforting sound in the world?
The most comforting sound in the world. I think I'm a big lover of dogs and animals in general. And I think just the friendly sound of a dog's bark when it isn't trying to eat you or anything like that, I think it's the most wonderful thing in the world to me. Like when my mom calls me and her dog's barking in the background, it's a comfort. So, yeah.
Next time you're in Pittsburgh, I'll make sure you meet Libby. She does this great woo-woo thing when she's really excited to see people. It's the best.
Nice. My mom's dog, Grace, does this little dance where she'll like go around in a circle. It's pretty great.
Sweet. All right. Question five. We're almost through this. Actually, I
Okay.
should have ended with that one, but because that's a nice one. This one maybe this can court controversy. Question five. What is a sacred cow slash canonical text that you hate in spite of the fact that everybody seems to revere it?
A nautical text.
Yeah, canonical text. Like something that everybody's gotta like this man.
Oh,
Except you
okay.
don't.
Yeah, I don't know. I always say, like, I'm just happy if people are reading anything. And I guess, and I do mean that. I do mean it. I do, but I put out a chapbook called Rupi Kaur Is Not on Medicaid. Because it's very true. It's very true. She's made quite a bit of money, and I don't begrudge her, but I don't know if her poems are terrible or if they're just so simple that I just kind of don't understand them. And I meet a lot of, particularly a lot of young women who just love her and they adore her. And I'm like, man, it's just nonsense to me. But which would probably get me a lot of hate. Her, Amanda Lovelace. And like, don't get me wrong, I'm glad that they're doing what they're doing, because if I had my way, everyone would write poetry. But we all like what we like and don't like what we don't like. So.
Or, I always say with stuff like that is maybe that's like the first level, like basic. Like there was a time in my life, and I am a music snob uncontrollably, when U2 was the most important band in the world to me. U2, Joshua Tree. I didn't know better. I hadn't heard like I hadn't heard anything yet. And maybe that's what Rupi Kaur is.
Yeah, maybe. I am not a fan of U2.
I'm not anymore.
I probably liked them better when I was younger. But now, like most of my music that I listen to, I get from suggestions from YouTube. And I'll tell you what, they've got me down cold because they suggest some great stuff. Although stuff from the past, what I've recently picked up the Cranberries again. And I had not listened to them in a very long time. And I really kind of spellbound by them. And I don't think I was when I was younger.
Yeah, and I mean, it's so sad Dolores passing away in such a sort of senseless, accidental way. But that last single they put out, right around when she passed away, is so
Oh,
good. Like
yeah.
she still had it. Dolores still had it.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. Yeah, I watched their NPR Tiny Desk concert from probably like 2012, 2013. Man, she was on it. She was probably about 40 at that time, and she'd been doing this a long time. But just today I found I subscribed to this channel on YouTube that's like for sort of like DIY punk kind of ethos stuff out of Chicago. And it's all these little groups that are issuing albums on cassette and like 50 copy pressings. And so just today I found two more bands that I've just kind of fallen in love with. And that's the sort of stuff that I like the hard to find obscure things. And I
Yes.
hope I keep finding them.
Yes. There is so much in so many cities and so many things happening. Yeah. Which makes us feel infinite, or at least makes me feel infinite. Like we're not going to run out.
Yeah, I mean, no, there'll never be a point where there isn't anything for you to listen to. It's just or anything to read or anything like that. It's just a matter of whether or not you find it out there in the world, but it's there. Yeah, one of the big developments for me in my life, I don't know if you know this gentleman. Do you know Matthew Vetter?
That name sounds familiar, but I'm also, like we said, I can't hold a grocery list in my head for 15 minutes, so.
He teaches English and rhetoric at IUP.
I should know him then, because I came from that department.
Well, he and I have recently become pretty good friends, and he actually was the guy who just, in the last few months, wrote my Wikipedia article.
Sweet.
And I didn't know him before that. He approached me, and it's become like it's been a nice correspondence. It's the best part of it.
Well, I graduated from that department, right? I guess he came after my time. My time was a long time ago.
So how old are you?
I am 47.
Yeah, I'm 48. He is I think he's like about 35, 36.
Okay. And I that was my MA and PhD program. And you know what? March 22nd will be the 13th anniversary of my defense day. So I've been away from IUP for a while.
Well, I'm sure the party is still going on.
It
It's
still
the
is, yes, and IU Patty's Day and all of that.
man, I read at the Appalachian Folk Festival, which was held in Indiana, and in just this past September, and it's still a raging party.
Yes. So, well, we have to do a recap, but I think that's about it. So, the most recent things out, Sacred Millennial Burial Ground, which I should say is also split with Kevin Ridgway, right?
Yes.
Yes. So,
Which
that is
I
out.
should have. Yeah.
Dead Photographs, which are erasure poems based on the poems of, or the genesis of, is the poems of Barry Gifford, is out on Stubborn Mule Press and Dark Heart Press as Sacred Millennial Burial Ground.
Yes.
And Bottle of Smoke Press has the delightfully short, we didn't really talk about it actually, the Essential Heartbeats for Fried Chicken Nights, which is a delightful little chapbook.
I'm the only place to get that now because when Bill
Oh.
made those, he did that as sort of Bill Roberts from Bottle of Smoke and I have been friends for over 20 years. And every once in a while he'll be like, "Oh, do you feel like making a little book?" And so he'll just make something for me. And a lot of times he'll give me all of the copies because he just wanted to do it. So I actually have the few remaining copies of that.
Ooh, see, you gotta find. I'll put links, everybody. And so upcoming, you have March 19th, you're reading in Portsmouth, Ohio.
Yes. And then
Beautiful.
May 19th, I'll be reading at the Sacramento Poetry Center in Sacramento, California.
Okay. And you have a book coming out in Germany on Sacred Parasite Press called 100 Mornings.
Yes.
Yes. And wait, there's more. My notes are terrible. Look, this is my handwriting, and this is
Yeah, that's kind of how my notes come out too.
yes. So yeah, I need a spreadsheet.
Yep. We all need it.
Yes. All right. Our next episode will eventually happen, and who knows, it might be with John Dorsey again. I don't know. The world is chaos. And it'll be
Is.
about something. I don't know. Our homepage where you can find new and old episodes is goodtodiepodcast.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube. We're on the YouTube podcast, YouTube music thing, which means also if anybody wants to read along with captions, that is now an option if you want it. And we're still on Facebook, and maybe I'll start some other social networking thing for this because that's how the world works, I guess. Thank you so much, John Dorsey. Let's do this again in like 6 months or something, which actually
Yeah.
still might be the next episode. Who knows? I
All
need
right.
an
Well,
intern and a spreadsheet. I need a spreadsheet with an intern in order to do these episodes more regularly, but I don't have either of those things, so.
Jason Reber's been talking about taking on an intern, so maybe we all need one of those too.
We all need unpaid interns.
Yes.
Yes. All right. And thank you to Andrew Fox for the lovely theme music. Later, Meets.